You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, happy Friday. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie was with us on Wednesday because he can't be with us today. So today we will not be a brunch with Bernie Day. It's just going to be anything goes Friday. And I will get to you. In fact, the lines are already starting to fill up for anything goes Friday. Hopefully, not people thinking that they can talk to the senator. You can talk to me. Anyway, there's a couple of things I just wanted to touch on. Just wanted to go over before we, some of the things that I think are interesting, the interesting stories of the day. You will recall a week ago and then maybe 3 weeks ago. Well, actually, I've had this conversation with you probably a dozen times in the last few months. And over the last couple of years, as I was writing The Crash of 2016, I kept coming back to this theme because it appears in the book, which is the idea that there's a lot of similarity between 2014 and 1914. And the world is in a very precarious place, both economically and geopolitically. And that, as the probably apocryphal statement that has been attributed to various folks, that when the last man dies who remembered the horrors of the last great war, when he dies, the next great war becomes inevitable. That, in other words, we forget the lessons of history, and then we repeat the mistakes of history. And we, this is so clear. I mean, Phil Graham and his buddies at the behest of Ken Lay, blowing up the Glass-Steagall Act and pushing through the Commodity Futures Modernization Act in 99 and 2000, and Bill Clinton signing them, and everybody just thinking, oh yeah, okay, yeah, it's worked well for 60 years. I guess we don't need it anymore. And why did that happen? Well, if Graham had introduced that legislation, Graham Leach Bliley, into Congress in 1950, when there were members of Congress who had been alive in the 1920s, when in 21 and 22 and 23, Harding was aggressively deregulating banks and Wall Street and cutting taxes. And they had lived through the 20s, and they saw the crash in 29 as a result of the crash of housing in 27, the crash of the stock market in 29, the unemployment rate fall to, in early 1933, to over 35%, and every single bank in the country collapse in March of 33. People who had lived through that, they were in Congress in the 1950s. And if Phil Graham had introduced that, Graham Leach Bliley or the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, he wouldn't just have been laughed out of the chamber. He probably would have been tarred and feathered. not tarred and feathered, but he certainly never would have been reelected by his constituents because they all remembered it too. But by 2000, hey, that was 70 years ago. It was 80 years ago if you really wanted to, the beginning of it. The big mistakes were made in 1921, 22, and 23. That was 80 years ago from 2000. I mean, it was 95. It was almost 100 years ago from now. And so there was nobody in Congress. I know Bill Clinton looks at the legislation. He has no recollection of this. What were the mistakes that led to this? I mean, there were a few people on the sidelines. There were the Paul Krugmans and the Robert Reiches and the Byron. Oh, and Byron Dorgan, who were saying, well, I've read some history books. And you guys are making a big mistake. And they were right. And we haven't, by the way, fixed those mistakes, so our economy is still at risk. Well, same thing with international relations. And you'll remember I was concerned. I mean, in 1914, Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo by a Serbian nationalist, as I recall. And because the Austrian Empire that he represented and the Serbs had all these, interlocking, we'll defend you if you're attacked kind of agreements, You had country after country declaring war on each other simply because they had to, or they felt, you know, compelled to by nationalist sentiments. And we ended up with World War One, and to this day, nobody knows why World War One was really fought, other than that, you know, you had all these stupid treaties. And here we are today. And Ukraine has a defense treaty with NATO, and they have a defense treaty with Russia. And, you know, I have speculated about, you know, what might be the flashpoint if we were to see a 1914 scenario play out that leads to World War III. What would be the flashpoint? There was a time when we thought it was going to be Cuba when I was a kid. There was a time when we thought it was going to be Germany. Actually, I remember the Berlin airlift. More recently, I've suggested that it might be, in fact, and it still might be, these islands in this large chunk of water off the coast of the Philippines, and the water and the air territory off the coast of the Philippines that China has claimed, and more recently, that was 6-8 months ago, and more recently the one off the coast of Japan, and now the Japanese and the U.S. are penetrating that airspace. Could that be it? Because we have a defense treaty with Japan, and China has one with Russia, and boom, there you go, off to the races. Japan has one with Western Europe. But the Ukraine, this is how I grew up with it. You know, it was the Ukraine, and Ukraine means border, but it's Ukraine. But Ukraine, you know, the eastern half of Ukraine is ethnically Russian. They all speak Russian. The western half of Ukraine is ethnically Ukrainian and more European, and they all speak Ukrainian. Not all is a horrible overgeneralization, but this is pretty much the eastern half is the breadbasket. It's sort of like our Midwest. The western half is more rural. It's more like eastern Oregon or Idaho. Mountains and trees. They speak different languages. Yushchenko, the current president of Ukraine, just learned to speak Ukrainian in his 50s. And so this is a very, 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 I mean, you know, this is a country that could very easily, in my opinion, fall into civil war. And John Kerry was blowing off steam about it last weekend, which I was complaining about on Monday on the radio on this program, and saying, I don't think this is a good idea. And now this story of, you know, this American diplomat, a couple of American diplomats talking about which Ukrainian politicians they were going to basically put or keep in power without getting into all the minutiae of it, was put up on YouTube and then tweeted by the Russians, and they're saying, hey, you know, you're messing in the internal affairs of Ukraine, which is on our border. This is the equivalent of the Russians interfering in the internal affairs of Canada. How would we feel about that? What if we discovered that the Trans-Pacific Pipeline was actually, you know, something that had been set up by Moscow? And what if Canada, what if the secession movement in Quebec was, you know, really had reached the point where people were like burning cars and lighting cities on fire, which is going on in Ukraine? It's a tinderbox. So I'm just, you know, I'm concerned about this. And I think we all need to keep an eye on this. The other thing is economic. And I want to share with you the Financial Times news mine and the job report today. Share with you, you know, some insights into that. I will do that in 4.5 minutes. And then we'll open the calls and open the lines. And for the rest of the day, it's anything goes right. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, and by the way, mounting behavior about lead. Why has crime gone down in the United States? I got to tell you about this science stuff. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And here we go. Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Should I call you Detroit or Johnny O?
No, either one. That's fine.
Okay. How you doing, Detroit?
Yeah. I'm a cat person just like you.
Uh-huh.
I've got four of them, right?
Whoa.
And I got these twins. They're like going on 4 years old, three and a half, three and three quarters. They'd be to four on Memorial Day. Anyways, the male, he thinks he's a reflexologist. He walks on my back. When I take a breath, you know, I'm laying down. He's on my back. He massages my legs, my lower back, and it comes all the way up to my shoulders almost. It takes about 15 minutes. It's hilarious.
That's great. You know, cats do that because they think that you're mom, and it's they're just kind of remembering nursing, you know, but but if he's doing it in an organized fashion and you end up with a massage out of it, geez, I mean, you know, most of us have to pay for that.
He's incredible. And I just want to add one other little statement from the Johnny Old Bible that I'd like to make. It'll take 1 minute. You know, one voice means more than you know. And some of us know that the world has been shaped by a drunken barber, but we all need to know that.
By a what?
By a drunken barber.
A drunken barber.
A drunken barber, yeah. Maybe a few of them in New York.
So we've got bleeding nicks all over our face? Is that the world does?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe. Anyway, telling us what we need, what we need to say, and what we got to do.
Right.
All I say is, you know, free your mind and your ass will follow.
Yeah.
There are no black people in this world. There are no white people because black and white are not colors. Hello.
Yeah, actually, right. White is the presence of all colors and black is the absence of any colors, and neither one really applies to human beings. Excellent point, Johnny. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Yesterday on C-SPAN, I heard of a House Resolution Bill, number 20, that's supposed to increase the average donors to politician rate by a factor of 6 or 7. If you can say contribute $50, it makes that $50 $300. Now, I think its subtitle was We the People.
Was this a public funding of elections bill?
I believe it was.
Yeah. You know, if there's a cap on the size of the contribution that gets matched by the federal government, that would be a really good thing because it would allow the average person to make a donation that would actually have some consequence. If there's no cap, then it means that the Koch brothers could give $100 million and it becomes $600 million, and it's a bad thing. Does that make sense?
True. True.
But if you could give $20 to somebody and know that it had $100 worth of impact, I mean, you know, that would be, and let's say the cap was, you know, $50 or $100 for public matching. I think that would be a great idea because it would allow the average working person to become more of a player in politics, you know, at least until we overturn Citizens United, until we pass a constitutional amendment saying that money is not protected by the First Amendment. So. Interesting, Randy. I'll have to track that down. What did you say? Was Senate Bill 20?
Yeah, H.R. 20.
Or House Resolution 20. Okay. Yeah, the Government by the People Act. Oh, that was introduced by John Sarbanes last week. Yeah, Bernie actually was saying that he thought that was a pretty good piece of legislation. So you might want to dig a little deeper into it, Randy. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour, so here just to, you know, a couple more news things I want to share with you, and then we can just kick around the whole, you know, the topics of the whole week as you wish as we go through the next 2.5 hours on the program here. As many of you know, for many years I have subscribed to the Financial Times. They are not an advertiser. This is not a plug. You know, let me make that very, very clear. But the reason that I've subscribed is, it used to be basically, now they've got an American Bureau and an American edition and all that kind of thing, but it used to be a very British publication. And so you got this kind of European worldview, which I found fascinating. And secondly, it's always useful to listen in when the rich people are talking to the rich people. Right? I mean, it's kind of the premise of the movie, The Butler, I guess, but, well, actually not really. But in any case, that's more of a Forrest Gump movie. This is a pretty good movie. But in any case, as a subscriber, once a week, they send out a summary of the top stories of the week in email. And I got mine this morning. And it's called the Financial Times Newsmine, the week ending Friday, 7th February. And Every single one of these top stories is shocking, and I just have to share with you. And I think this is just amazing. It's got to be a coincidence, or we're much closer to an edge than I thought. Okay, the first story is financial. It's on lending by shadow banks, and it's from the February 6th edition of the paper. And here's the quote. And here's, I'll tell you why it's significant first, and then I'll read you the quote, and you can, so the penny will drop. Shadow banking is something that largely didn't exist before Graham Leach Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. That's these institutions that are not regulated as banks, acting, you know, doing things with money that traditionally was done with banks and was regulated. And the more of that that happens, the riskier it is for our economy, because the shadow banking folks take incredible risks. This is where the derivatives trading is happening. This is where, you know, these are the hedge funds. This is kind of stuff. Okay. Quote, banks issue 73% of the middle market loans last year, according to data from Thomson Reuters, down from 81% in 2012. It is the lowest proportion. In other words, banks are issuing fewer loans, which means the shadow banks are issuing more. It is the lowest proportion since the 62% share reported in 2006 at the height of the credit bubble. Now, in 2006, at the height of the credit bubble, we were down to the point where 48% of all banking, or 38% of all banking, was being done by non-banking institutions, 62% by banks. Now it's 27%. I'm doing my subtraction wrong, aren't I? I should just stick with the numbers. It used to be that in 2006, this is a warning sign. Banks were only issuing 62%. In 2012, it was 81%. That's better. Now it's 73%, just 1 year later. This is not good news. Okay, that was from Friday's paper, or from Thursday's paper, from Wednesday's paper. This is about how companies are able to raise money, basically. In equity. In other words, people will invest in companies. Here's this big problem that people aren't investing in companies. People aren't starting companies. Instead, they're sitting on cash. And I did this story last week about how there's, you know, literally almost a little over $2 trillion. In fact, here's the story. It was in the Financial Times. The headline was, huge cash pile puts recovery in hands of few. Just five companies sitting on $387 billion and over $2 trillion, just literally sitting in bank accounts or in treasuries or that kind of thing. Well, here's more evidence. February 5th, quote, companies have raised about $17 billion in equity so far this year in the wake of a sell-off in benchmark stock indices. This sharply down from $22 billion in the same period in 2013, according to Dealogic. The slide in the sale of junk bonds is even more pronounced. That would be, you know, companies that are new companies, smaller companies, startup companies, which are leading indicators of the economy. The slide in sale of junk bonds is even more pronounced. Corporate borrowers with fragile balance sheets sold $27 billion worth of debt compared with $43 billion the previous year, a 36% decline. When you see a year-over-year decline of anything, that's 36%. I pointed out to you before that in 2006, when I saw the housing market drop 34%, I said, that's it, the stock market's going to crash. Here you see this is in the corporate bond market. On Tuesday, the headline, or the story, the quote, the headline was on the performance of emerging markets. So these are the countries that are coming into the industrialized world. China, Brazil, Russia, India, et cetera, right? The MSCI Emerging Markets Index is now trading at only 8.9 times expected earnings, compared with 14.4 times for global stocks as a whole. Emerging market equity outflows totaled $12.2 billion in January, according to EPFR Global. In other words, the emerging markets, the countries that were really starting to pick up some steam, the famous BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, they're not doing so well. And this is another bad leading indicator. And then they've got the Asian story and the miscellaneous story. Another one, Russia's economy. Growth in GDP plummeted from 3.4% in 2013 to just 1.3% last year. This is because their economy is so dependent upon exports of fossil fuels, I believe. Cost of coffee beans rose 22% in the first 6 weeks of this year. This is a commodities bubble of some kind. Something's going on. Somebody's playing with this market. Gideon Rockman, in their recent book, Emerging Markets, Coase and Pradosh show that the economies of a group of the most prominent emerging markets have grown by 600% since 1960, compared with 300% for the richer countries.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
All of this, in my mind, adds up to the fact that we are in another bubble. We need to stop the Reaganomics. Tom Hartman here with you. This last little bit, and then I'm going to pick up the phone. I promise. The jobs numbers came out. One in six men between the ages of 25 and 54. These are the prime working years. One in six men, 25 to 54, are not working. They don't have a job in the United States. 10.4 million men. Between the ages of 25 and 54. A lot of them are not showing up in the unemployment statistics because they've just given up working, looking for work. In fact, as people have fallen off the unemployment rolls as a result of the Republicans refusing to renew long-term unemployment benefits, many of those people are going to give up looking for work because, you know, I mean, a lot of these people live in rural areas where, you know, the industry used, you know, they used to have a textile factory here and we made socks or we made blue jeans and that went to China back 20 years ago and there's nothing. You know, you can sharpen your neighbor's chainsaws, but you can only do so much of that. One in six men in America. We are looking at 32 years of failed trade policy and 32 years of failed tax policy, which are really one and the same thing because your trade policies are driven by taxes. You tax imported goods or you don't tax imported goods. It's called tariffs. It's a tax policy. Tariffs paid for 100% of the cost of the government of the United States from the presidency of George Washington. Tariffs paid for everything during the Washington presidency. Tariffs paid to build the White House. Tariffs paid to build the Capitol building. Tariffs paid to build everything from the presidency of George Washington until the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. Tariffs paid for 2/3 of all the functions of government from the presidency of Abraham Lincoln until World War I. And tariffs paid for 1/3 of everything that the federal government did from World War I to World War II, to the end of World War II. And now tariffs pay for nothing because, you know, our tariffs are nothing. So, you know, insane trade policies, insane tax policies, the billionaires are stashing and multinational corporations sitting on $2 trillion that they will not put into the economy because they're holding their breath, too. Jared, Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared.
Tom, the reason I call is because I wanted to talk to you about 1914.
Yes, sir.
There was some conversation about back a few weeks ago, and then today you gave the perfect lead into what I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Some time ago, China got a stealth fighter. South Korea has just contracted to buy 20 F-35s
right.
at about 1.5 million a copy. Japan, Prime Minister Abe is trying to rewrite the history books.
He's not just trying to rewrite the history books. He's also trying to rewrite Japanese law that makes their army a purely defensive force and prevents them from being a nuclear armed power.
Precisely. And then yesterday in the Times, there was an article about the president of the Philippines. I believe his name is Aquino.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's Cory Aquino's
wanting to rotate U.S. troops through rather than having them stationed there, rotate them through as kind of a deterrent to to China, because they're quite concerned.
Yeah, they want to increase U.S. troop presence in the Philippines.
Correct.
Yeah.
You were looking at 1914, and I would look at 2014, China Sea and the Philippines as perhaps another tinderbox.
Yeah. I mean, this is what
all the potential, because if one of them goes, suddenly we're involved with all of them.
That's correct.
It's not just us.
Also, you know, so is Russia. So are many of the Western European countries. I don't know the details of NATO treaties with any of those countries in Southeast Asia, but I'm guessing that they're there. I don't know if SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as the TPP, if SHAFTA has any military piece to it. I kind of doubt it. But it hasn't passed anyway. So I guess that's a peripheral concern. But I think that your information is, I know your information is absolutely right. So
I would like to give you a what if sort of unintended consequences.
Sure.
If the Falkland Islands, when the Argentines and the Brits were fighting back and forth,
right.
If the Brits had invaded Argentina, then under the Rio Treaty, I think the United States would be obliged to defend Argentina.
Well, there was a discussion at the time. Because Maggie Thatcher had invaded the Falklands, that we had an obligation to defend the Falklands. And that conversation didn't go anywhere, but, you know, because our relationship with the UK is a special relationship. But there was discussion in the press at the time about that.
If the Brits had invaded Argentina, then under the Rio Treaty, I think we would have had to go after the Brits. And anyway, that's kind of an aside. The reason I was calling is your comment about some weeks ago about 1914.
Yeah.
You know, I see this happening, you know, the possibility happening again.
Yeah, well, and in the era from 1914 to 1935, basically, we had this not only very, very similar conflicts happening in the South Pacific, but you also had this conflict happening in Europe and in the heart of Europe, Germany. And around Germany, in Italy and in Spain, and where you had the Spanish Revolution that had happened and you know the outcome of all this stuff, this post World War I stuff, and the Treaty of Versailles and everything. I would submit to you that while Ukraine is not anything close to that in intensity or violence or whatever you want to call it, it still represents. In 1914, nobody thought that assassinating Archduke Ferdinand would cause World War One. Let me put it that way. And that's why I think that 1914 is a better metaphor for today than, frankly, 1935 or 36 or 39 when Hitler invaded Poland.
Right. Right. Well, anyway, I wanted to give my pearls of opinion to Bernie, but you're a good stand-in.
Okay, well, thank you.
You've been talking about this for quite some time.
Yeah,
but anyway.
For years.
Thanks a lot. I'll get off the line.
Okay, Jared, thanks a lot for watching us on Free Speech TV on the cable system there in Burlington, Vermont. And thanks for the call. David in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, David.
Hi. I'm one of the 1 in 6 who are unemployed. So,
oh, my.
Yeah, it's a pretty dysfunctional labor market out there. Companies are claiming they can't find people, and yet the hiring practices are totally foobar. Like the guy who developed the banana market for the U.S. in the early 1900s, his advice to his managers was, don't be smarter than the problem. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of companies that are overcomplicating the hiring process. Plus Section 1706 of the IRS code, but as reported by David K. Johnston over the years. But I want
which says what?
Well, basically, I brought this up before. Joe Stack, who flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin, basically what he was protesting: Section 1706 passed in 1986 by Moynihan to offset a $60 million tax break for overseas operations that right. IBM lobbied. So Moynihan said, where am I going to get that $60 million? I know all these independent individual data processing people, they called back then, they're probably not paying their taxes because they're going directly to corporations. So we're going to make corporations prove whether they're employees or whether they're contractors. This scared a lot of corporations away from hiring individuals. It spawned a whole body shop, corporate intermediary industry, which is basically dumbed down the hiring.
No, I know what you're talking about now, David. In fact, in the crash of 2016, we opened the second chapter with the story of Joe Stack.
But anyway, that's the background. And David K. Johnston reported on this several times, including specifically addressing what Stack did in 2010.
Right.
So, but to get to your point about the $2 trillion, Hedrick Smith recently spoke in Chicago, and he mentioned that of the $2 trillion, companies took about $750 billion of that to buy back their own stock, which makes me wonder if what we're seeing is...
That's in addition to the $2 trillion, because the $2 trillion is still sitting there.
Well, that could be, but he mentioned $750 billion.
Right.
So in other words, which makes me wonder whether it's part of the stock market thing. It's kind of an artificial bubble in a way because of all this money just laying around. It, which speaks to the bigger issues. What we have here is a decoupling between our capital markets and the people that control them and the real everyday free market economy that most people live in.
You're absolutely right.
This is further evidence of that is brought up.
And that decoupling happened through the decade of the 1920s, and that decoupling was happening gradually, as we went into the Reaganomics era from the mid-80s until 2000. But then it really, really picked up steam with the deregulation of the banks in 2000. And in 2001 through 2006, the decoupling was complete. And you saw this huge bubble emerge, first in the housing market and then in the real, and then first in the real estate market and then in the stock market. And that bubble burst in the housing market in late 2006, early 2007. And it burst in the stock market in 2008. And that bubble did not completely burst in either of those markets. And that's the problem. We didn't fix the structural problem. We didn't stop the bubble machine. And so, the bubbles are growing again, and they're going to burst again. I hate to be a doomsayer. I think that there's opportunities here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the principal opportunity here is that this is how it always happens in capitalist societies. And when it bursts, then we get to change our politics. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick. You wanted to talk about 1914? Rick watching Free Speech TV in Weston, West Virginia? Rick is watching his TV rather than listening on the phone, apparently. Sarah watching Free Speech TV in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. You are on the air, Sarah.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am fine, thank you. I hope you are well.
Hanging in there. It's cold.
It is.
You had mentioned this thing about Rick Scott yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me of a story that Rachel Maddow had done. I believe it was about October or November of last year.
Mm-hmm.
There was an elected official, I believe it was Idaho, who was convicted of forced rape in Florida, served time for it, and had another conviction or another arrest or something.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, while he was an elected official, he was allowed to have a gun carry permit.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was an elected official, after they found out about his conviction, they couldn't take away his guns.
Right.
And I didn't know if you had heard about that story. And I'm wondering, what's the vetting process for elected officials these days?
Well, yeah, I do recall that story. I don't recall all the details, but I believe that your characterization is pretty close to accurate, if not spot on. The vetting process obviously is supposed to be, we the people, and that you actually get candidates who oppose you, aggressively try to find out if there's anything that they can't oppose you on, like, gee, this person was convicted of rape. One of the problems that we have, and I don't know if this is the case in this case, but I would bet that it was. One of the problems we have is a consequence of gerrymandering, of 200 years of gerrymandering, basically. We have congressional districts that are by and large, there are some swing districts in the United States, but contestable districts. But the vast majority of congressional districts are, you know, whoever gets through the primary process is the Republican is going to win in the red ones. And you know that whoever gets through the primary process is a Democrat is going to win in the blue ones. And it doesn't matter who they could put up. They could put up Mother Teresa against them if she was still alive, and she would not win. And so what happens is, in these uncontestable districts, is you get token opposition candidates. You get an opposition candidate who's you know, the party's putting up because they got to have somebody on the ticket, but they're giving them $25,000 to run their campaign. And that person has no resources to do opposition research. They have no resources to dig back into the history of the candidate from the other party. And if the press happens to stumble across it, as happened in this case, then the guy gets outed. But otherwise, you know, really, really crackpot folks. I mean, I would say, frankly, Art Robinson in Oregon is an example of that. But, you know, the guy who ran against Peter DeFazio. Although, actually, his weirdness, his idea that we should put radioactive waste, nuclear waste, in everybody's house as part of the insulation, because, gee, it produces heat. And it's like, you know, it was widely known in Oregon when I lived there. But, sir, I'm guessing that's what happened. And I think, you know, we can't mandate vetting. That would be legislatively interfering with the electoral process. So I think we just need to be more active as citizen voters. Thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. I see KBCS 91.3 FM in Seattle area carries our show. And thank you for doing so. And apparently they're having a fund drive, because they just tweeted out, Tom Hartman listeners, you can call to contribute now, 425-564-5000, or give online at kbcs.fm. So, you know, let me salute our, you know, one of our Pacifica stations, one of our nonprofit affiliates is supported by its listeners. Whenever any of our affiliates are doing fund drives, you know, let me know, and I'll mention it on the air, just like with our commercial stations. If you want me to record commercials for your local advertisers, if they're advertisers that, you know, I've visited or I, you know, that you can assure me are good folks, typically people that I know, I come to these towns a lot. I'm pleased to record ads for them. So we want to support our affiliates. And by the way, for the folks at KBCS, my actual Twitter feed is not at Tom Hartman. It's at @Tom_Hartman. At Tom Hartman is one that I grabbed way back years ago for just personal stuff, and I've never used. So it comes to my email, but nobody else sees it. I think it's like, you know, maybe there's 9 followers in my family or something. So it's @Tom_Hartman if you want to hit the whole public out there. Mark in Randolph, Vermont. Hey, Mark, you wanted to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a.k.a. SHAFTA?
Yes, sir. Okay. How are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope you are, too.
I got a couple quick questions here. Number one, is there any way the public can get a copy of the TPP?
No, it is. It has been negotiated entirely in secret. Two sections of it, one having to do with copyrights and one having to do with financial services, as I recall, and the environment, have been leaked on WikiLeaks. And so wherever the WikiLeaks website is these days, you can find those. But they were early drafts. We haven't seen the final drafts. And they are just a very small piece of the larger whole. It's being negotiated by 600 corporate lawyers, and they will then hand it to President Obama, and he is trying to get legislation passed through Congress that will give him the authority to require Congress to vote up or down on it without debate and without amendment. This is called fast track, and that fast track legislation is before Congress right now. And if you want to stop the TPP, you need to stop fast track, because without stopping fast track, TPP will probably pass. And fast track has been introduced. The president gave a shout out to it in his last speech. He said, we should pass this thing. And it's called the Bipartisan Trade Act. So you got the clip? Oh, here it is.
And when 98% of our exporters are small businesses, new trade partnerships with Europe and the Asia Pacific will help them create even more jobs.
Here it comes.
We need to work together on tools like bipartisan trade promotion authority to protect our workers, protect our environment, and open new markets to new goods stamped made in the USA.
Right. We've heard this song before, and it's the Bipartisan Trade Promotion Authority. That's a fancy word, phrase for fast track. And Harry Reid has said now, you know, don't talk to me about this. And God bless him for it. But you will not hear about this in the mainstream media. You will not hear about this in the corporate media because these large media conglomerates are transnational corporations themselves, and they rather like this stuff. But this Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, a.k.a. SHAFTA, also known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this should not see the light of day, in my opinion.
Now, do you think if they did release it, what was in there, to the public, that the public might start going the way of the public of the Ukraine?
I think that there's a possibility, and that's why they're not going to do it. What they're going to do is they're going to drop it in Congress's lap. If they can get fast-track authority, they're going to drop it in Congress's lap and say you've got, you know, 1, 2, 3 days, whatever, some short, very short period of time to vote, to debate this. I think it's limited to 20 or 30 hours of debate, and you may not amend it, and then you must vote on it, and it's a simple majority. And they've got a simple majority in both the House and Senate that the large corporations own, and it will be a bipartisan majority. They've bought some Democrats, they've bought a lot of Republicans, and this is if you hated NAFTA and you didn't like CAFTA, SHAFTA is really going to horrify you.
Really bad.
Trust me, yeah, it's really bad. So, but to stop SHAFTA, we've got to stop the fast track, which is the bipartisan trade promotion authority that the president was calling for in his speech. Thank you for the call. Teresa in Bellevue, Washington, listening to KBCS. Hey, Teresa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's good out here. It's exciting to talk to you, and I'm so glad KBCS picked you up last year. I'm very happy about that.
Me too.
What I wanted to talk to you about is I don't hear this argument very often in support of living wages. And if I remember right from my college economics, there's like three pieces that you need to have the free market to function. In free market theory, there's perfect competition,
right,
perfect information,
right,
and the third one is no externalities.
Right.
So when I hear these people go on and on, like Rand Paul or, excuse me, you know, those types about how we need to let the free market work with setting our wages, I just kind of want to pull my hair out. It's like, you know, in the free market, there are no externalities. The taxpayers are not subsidizing these low, you know, these corporations to pay their low wages. It's totally against the free market.
Right. Well, in reality, there is no such thing as a free market. I mean, the closest you could get to it is, you know, I'll mow your lawn if you'll wash my car. You know, where basically there are no externalities that are influencing either of us. Although you could argue that the exhaust from the lawnmower or the, I don't know, and we have perfect information, and you know, beyond that, there really is no such thing as a free market. Markets are created by government.
Yeah, well, and see, in my own little number four is a referee to make sure points 1, 2, and 3 get at least worked towards. You know, it's an ideal, it's a theoretical thing, but you know, we sort of try to point in that direction, as certainly the right wingers try to, you know.
Well, we've been doing the opposite. You have companies that are lobbying for legislation and regulation that actually protects them rather than regulates them. For example,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, case in point, GMOs and Monsanto. You know, when Monsanto had developed GMOs back during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, there were no regulations on them. So they basically wrote the rules in such a way that only a big company like Monsanto could comply with those rules, so and thus blocking out any significant competition for about a decade. Teresa, I wrote about that in my book on equal protection, if you want the references. Teresa, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to KPCS.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico. 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
6 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday. And boy, we've got a lot of topics on the table. Are we looking at a repeat of 1914? Why should the Democratic Party go back to their party platform that was part of their party platform from the 1940s until 1988? I believe it was 44 to 88. It might have been 48 to 88. But it was part of the platform up until 1988 that the government is the employer of the last resort during times of economic crisis. If that was law right now, we would not have one in six men between the ages of 25 and 54 out of work. 10.4 million men. And that's, you know, not to mention women, but that's that particular statistic came across our desk today, and it was like, whoa. This is basically, we're wiping out a generation. We don't need to. Anyway, let's pick up your calls. Marty, watching us on Roku on Free Speech TV in Bluffton, South Carolina. Hey, Marty, TPP?
Yes, Shasta is a good name for it.
Did it? Well, it's the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, S-H-A-F-T-A. I don't know why they didn't call it that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's the president's plan to allow the party of no way to self-destruct. And it's brilliant, because when you're angry and you make a plan that will, you make it based on the way they do business. And when your people have been sold as slaves and kept under the boot heel even after they were supposedly set free, the anger burns, Tom. And when you are passed over and passed over and you can't get anything done when you get in power, then you let them self-destruct. The only thing is that any good people and the decent, innocent children are going to be harmed irreparably. And any country that signs on to it is going to be wiped out.
Yeah. I think that a lot of governments are going to take a lot of heat over Shasta, over the TPP. And if it gets to that point, and the simple fact of the matter is, though, that you've got a bunch of countries who are very reluctantly signing on to this thing, and they're only doing so on the assurance of the president that the United States will pass it. And but if he doesn't get his bipartisan trade promotion act through Congress, in other words, the fast track authority, if he doesn't get that, he's not going to get Shasta. He's not going to get the TPP. And so, I think, frankly, another trade policy would be a horrible legacy for this presidency.
Tom, what the problem with that is that he has made this plan out of anger, and he did make a plan.
Oh, no, this thing was in the works during the Bush administration. This thing has been around for a long time.
But he added things to it, Tom. He has added a lot to it. And what they don't understand is when they fast-track this thing without really understanding it, they're signing their death warrants as a party.
If you mean the Democrats?
I mean
or the
Republicans. Republicans and Democrats.
The whole thing. Yeah. You know, you may well be right. If we sign out of Shasta, if we sign out of the TPP and we lose another couple million jobs, to South Vietnam, and I mean, you know, the minimum wage is 39 cents a day. If that happens, then yeah, I think that could lead to that populist revolt. And it wouldn't be a Ross Perot candidate getting 20% of the vote. It would be the cities burning like they did in the early 70s. It would be a terrible, terrible thing. And worse than that, actually, because it would be more like the 30s. and the 1932, where you had the Bonus Army and the March on Washington and all that kind of stuff. You may have a very, very good point. Marty, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing that. Paul, in Renton, Washington, you wanted to talk about the Michigan Supreme Court case Dodge v. Ford?
Yes. I was watching American Experience, and they had a two-hour program on Ford, and I got a different perceptive from the Dodge v. Ford case than what I hear you giving me. First of all, they're at the UCLA School of Law under Law-ECO, research paper number 0711, and it's titled Why We Should Stop Teaching Dodge versus Ford. And basically they say is that though companies have a moral obligation to increase profits for their shareholders, they don't have a legal one, and that hasn't changed
before
or after that decision.
That's absolutely true. This was only a Michigan Supreme Court decision. It was not a United States Supreme Court decision. It does not apply to all companies. It is cited very often as the justification for putting profit ahead of everything else, but you're absolutely right. It does not establish case law in that direction.
Then you go back and look at the Dodge brothers. Basically, in 1900, they started out as an automotive parts manufacturer, and then they bought into Ford. They owned 10%. They were the largest minority shareholder of Ford. Mm-hmm. And then in 1915, they produced their own car.
Right.
In 1914, Ford sold their cars for $550, and then in 1950, he dropped it $100 to $450. And that's when the $5 wage thing also came in,
right?
And
he was competing with the
right.
Dodge brothers, with Horace Dodge.
There was also
almost 100 different car companies at that time in the United States, if my recollection of history is correct.
Right, but in order to get that $5 a day, you had to have your home inspected by the American Civil Society. And then you had to be an active member in your church, and then you had to take and speak English. And then you had to take classes after work in the American way.
Right, and Henry Ford would not hire you if you were Jewish.
Right, but you also had to prove that you were Americanized.
Right.
And in order for him to double...
That was, by the way, if I can just speak to that for a second, Paul, and this is a shameful moment in our history, but one that really influenced us all. My grandfather came to the United States around that time, in 1916, 1917, as an immigrant from Norway. And because that was not viewed as an aberration, that was just kind of conventional wisdom, my grandfather refused to teach my father Norwegian, would never speak Norwegian with my grandmother around my father. And I think I mourn that. I wish my dad had learned Norwegian. I wish he had taught it to me. Back to you.
My mother is full Danish, and her parents were the same.
Yeah, it was just the generation. That was the zeitgeist at the time.
But in 1914, Ford had to hire 52,000 people to maintain a 14,000 workforce.
Mm-hmm. Because he was running three shifts.
Well, he was working them 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, and people were quitting right and left. And he had to hire 52,000. To maintain the 14,000.
Oh, you mean over the course of a year, because he had high turnover.
He only needed 14,000 to run the factory, but he had to hire 52,000 to maintain that. So that was another reason he used that $5 an hour as
to provide worker stability.
Right, and okay. He was mostly used it as kind of a hype to get people in there, and he had a lot of people who came from other car manufacturers. Quit their jobs, at the other car manufacturers to work at Ford because of the promise, but it was really highly subsidized. And if every one of those workers, those 14,000 workers, bought a car at $450, it'd be about $6.3 million. And to double the wages for everybody to $5 would cost him $9 million, just south of $9 million.
Yeah.
So it was not an economic thing. It was
no, it wasn't. And if you dig a little deeper into the history, what you'll discover was that Henry Ford was actually opposed to raising the wage. His wife and his business partner, who went on to be a progressive state senator in the state of Michigan, and I can't remember his name, but something like Pierce, were the ones who were really the driving force behind this. And, Henry Ford reluctantly embraced it, but then later took credit for it very aggressively. Paul, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. The net consequence of all, you know, Henry Ford raised wages, the economy boomed, and so did Ford Motor. Maybe somebody should learn a lesson from that. And welcome back. Let's see here. Ruth, watching Free Speech TV in Ione, California. Am I saying it right, Ruth?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for calling.
Tom, is this. The Supreme Court gave corporations personhood.
Mm-hmm.
Did they give them citizenship?
No.
Okay, so then all the corporations are foreigners?
Well, that's a good question. Foreign corporations can be persons, but then foreign, you know, under the Constitution uses the word persons throughout. It doesn't use the word citizen except when referring to people who are qualified for public office. And so, and in the 14th Amendment, there is one reference to citizenship, but it, again, it has to do with, everybody who's born here is a citizen here. It's the birthright part. But where are you going with this, Ruth?
Well, couldn't they be treated as foreigners then? I mean...
But foreigners have rights in the United States as persons, too.
Yeah, but why do we let them in?
Well, in theory, we don't. Reagan stopped enforcing the laws that prevented employers from hiring people who are not citizens of the United States. And the consequence of that is that over 30 years, you had 11, 12 million people come here and just stay and work. A lot of those people did not cross the border in Mexico. Everybody talks about that, with all this hysteria. And they want to throw billions of dollars down to Texas to give to Rick Scott as a welfare program to stop people coming across the border from Mexico. But, you know, a really significant fraction of the, quote, illegal aliens in the United States are people who came here from other countries on tourist visas or on student visas or even on work visas and just stayed. And they never illegally crossed a border. They, you know, our borders are quite porous, quite open. You can fly into the United States from anywhere, you know, even countries that require, you know, where we require you to get a visa to come in. And in many cases, we don't require a visa. I had a friend when I was going to college who was here from the UK on a student visa. His visa expired, when he graduated from college. And, you know, he's still in the United States and he's still here illegally.
I know there's a lot of people. I know people like that too.
Yeah.
But what about so we can't tax them in any fashion or anything different from the regular citizens?
No, you mean regular corporations, domestic corporations? No,
yeah.
No, you can't. To the best of my knowledge, you can't draw a distinction between a. Well, there are some ways that foreign corporations are treated differently under law in the United States than domestic corporations. And typically to get around those kinds of rules, when those kinds of rules interfere with the corporation doing business, they will create an American subsidiary. So you have, you know, Volkswagen Incorporated in the United States that does business with Volkswagen Incorporated in Germany, for example.
So since they were born in the United States, so to speak, they're citizens.
Well, they're treated by the rules, the mostly tax rules, and some liability rules that are passed both by states and the federal government to regulate corporate behavior. Yeah. The Supreme Court didn't really say that corporations are persons. What they are human beings, are like human beings or like citizens. What they said was that corporations as artificial persons, you know, having these standings, should have some measure of 14th Amendment protection to due process, to equal protection under the law. And so they gave some of the rights of personhood to corporations, but not full rights. I mean, corporations can't get married, for example. Ruth, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Anything Goes Friday. So Mike in Lomita, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to state some reasons why I'm opposed to changing the name of the Washington Redskins football team. Maybe it'll work better if I ask you some questions rhetorically to make each of these points.
Okay.
If somebody calls you a liberal, are you insulted?
No, but I was not born that way.
Very good. Well, that's one of the points, is that I don't think the term Redskin is intrinsically insulting.
Do you think the term black skin is insulting?
Yes, it would be.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, if you're born that way and it's been used as a slur, and redskin is a phrase that Native Americans never used to refer to themselves, it's been a slur.
When we get to my third point, you may understand why I'm taking exception with that assertion of yours.
Your second point is?
Is that the name of the team is one of the few, maybe the only, recurring reminders in American culture that there were Americans here thousands of years before.
What about the Atlanta Braves?
I said one of the few.
Okay.
And Braves is not perhaps as legitimate a term, in my view, as Redskins.
But Braves was never used as a slur. Redskins, for a century or more, Redskins was the Native American equivalent of the N-word.
Yes, and liberal is basically an insult.
But you're not born. You're not born a liberal.
Well, if you're born to liberal parents and become a liberal,
I was born to conservative parents. My dad went to his grave. When he died right next to a picture of George Bush on the USS Abraham Lincoln.
Right. Well, the third reason is that if you happen to speak American, the term is a compliment. The term derived in the first place because the Eastern Coast Indians all spoke Algonquin languages. And in those languages, red is the color that's associated with the rising sun, the life force, walking in beauty, and truth. Mm-hmm. That's why these people, some of them were my ancestors, painted themselves red. And that's how the term redskin came about in the first place in the late 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may have become an epithet in Western movies of the 20th century.
Well, and throughout the late 19th century. In fact, throughout the 19th century.
Quite so. But, you know, I'd rather the team kept the name just as a reminder that these people were there, and maybe, you know, a small minority of curious kids would actually research it and find out why the term arose in the first place and what it meant.
Yeah. Well, if we're going to do that, maybe we should have teams with names, and I realize some of these words are offensive, but, you know, the New Jersey, I don't even want to use these words on the air, but, you know, the racial epithet that is used for Jews, or the racial epithet that is used for Italians, or the racial epithet that's used for Irish, why don't we have teams like that?
Is that the term redskin is not intrinsically insulting, however it may have been misapplied later just because it happened to apply to redskins as such.
Well,
are you insulted by the Minnesota Vikings, for instance?
No, I'm not, but Vikings was never a slur, but like WOP to describe Italians was very much a slur. Would you have the New Jersey WOPs?
Actually, Vikings was quite a slur in various parts of Europe for many centuries.
No, I think it was spoken in terror. The Vikings used to regularly raid the western coast of the United Kingdom. That's why there's all those castles.
What I'm saying is it's a parallel situation with Native American populations and white settlers. And it was considered a pejorative sort of thing, I think.
Well, if it was pejorative in Europe, then I would not, and I was naming a European team, I probably wouldn't do it. But I can tell you, as somebody of Norwegian ancestry, that I've spent a fair amount of time in Norway, that people of Norwegian ancestry think of Viking as they're pretty proud of it right now. And that is not the case with Native Americans in the word redskin.
Well, not everyone got to vote on this. Let me just make my point.
We're just about out of time here, so we do it quickly, Mike.
Yeah, and that is that there's a complete ignorance of Native American culture. For instance, do you know what Walla Walla means?
No.
Okay. That sort of makes my point that if people actually understood where these terms came from, there might not be this
See, I would say, Mike, the solution is not to keep this team name, an offensive team name, but rather to start saying in the curriculum of our schools, we need to be teaching about the Native American genocide and Holocaust, and we need to be teaching about the various nations that were here and the various peoples of those nations, and they were very different ethnically, religiously, in smaller ways, you could call it racially, in appearance, whatever. The difference, for example, between the Dene people and the Athabascan people and the Pueblo people, you know, there are significant cultural, language genetic is the wrong word, but you know, they can look at each other and say, oh, I know what you are, you know what I mean, and let's start teaching the history of the people who were here, but it's like Americans don't want to do that because they don't want to confront the fact that they've engaged in genocide.
Well, you're singing my tune, but. To me, redskin is a compliment, not an insult, so I'd rather keep the name.
Okay. Well, you know, if you are a Native American or you have Native American ancestry, I honor your perspective. I am in no, you know, it's not my place to contradict you. Is that all right?
Okay.
We'll just respectfully agree to disagree on this. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. I appreciate it. We'll be back, and thanks for listening to KPFK in Los Angeles there. It's another one of our Pacifica affiliates we're very pleased to be with. We will be back. It is, boy, my clock says we're going to this break a minute late, or we're coming out of it a minute late. I guess my clock is off. Okay. We will be right back. Apparently, it's 25 minutes past the hour. Is it? 20. It's 27. Oh, we're going into the bottom of the hour break. Oh, okay. My clock is down. We will be back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Don Siegelman is still in prison. Check it out. free-don.org. You 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Well, I think water will be the flashpoint for war. India, Pakistan, China, and they're all nuclear. You know, they're diverting rivers from each other because of drought. Even California has that drought problem. They're the same point from the equator as those countries.
Yes, it already is. The as much as we want to take credit, or Barack Obama might like to take credit for starting the Egyptian uprising, for example, you know, by going over to Egypt and standing with a dictator and saying, I don't stand with dictators. Really, what happened was the price of wheat went up because of a drought. And this is what led to the Syrian conflict. I mean, do a little bit of go to the DuckDuckGo.com machine and type in drought and Syria, drought and Egypt, or wheat drought and Egypt. I'm not sure what. Yeah, I haven't done this specific term. I've just read the articles, but there's a really good body of literature coming out of the diplomatic community and also out of the scientific community indicating that. You know, Libya, Syria, Egypt, you know, right across the board that these spring uprisings, these quote spring uprisings, were really motivated by the fact that food prices were exploding. And food prices were exploding because of global climate change. And so we've got massive regional instability already in the Middle East and already in Pakistan. And now, you know, and down in the south end of Bangladesh where you've got people being, you know, drowning out. I mean, you know, as the monsoons are getting worse and worse. So yeah, I don't disagree with you, Gary. And some of the Western countries are almost on the verge of war over water. And saw a headline the other day that there's 7 or 8, you know, major metro areas in California that are very, very close to having to that have already started rationing water and very close to actually running out. So yeah, it's a problem. You're absolutely right. Patrick in Park City, Utah. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Tom, so terrific to talk to you. I have been waiting 6 months to ask this question, and I can't wait to read The Crash of 2016, by the way.
Okay.
what really got me thinking about this is this kind of connectivity between your discussion earlier today and for the past few weeks about 1914. But going back to FDR's speech, I can't remember the year. Maybe it was 1930. Well, when he said, I welcome their hate.
It was 1936.
1936. Thank you.
They are united in their hatred against me, and I welcome their hatred.
Exactly. One of the greatest, I think, moments in our presidency, the history of the presidency, considering all things considered. But, you know, in context of 1914, currently, I think that 9/11 and September 15th, 2008 were two shots over the bow compared to the disaster that's on the horizon. You know, you look at the continued financial imbalance that you talked about earlier. You've got Keystone XL coming online. It looks like it's going to come online. This continued revolving door, the problem's just getting more and more and more entrenched. And, you know, you're talking about tender boxes, but isn't it ultimately just like Occupy Wall Street talked about initially? It is the 99% versus the 1%. So even though there's these tender boxes around the world, it's not quite the same theater, if you will, of what maybe took place, I suppose, after 19, in World War One. Although I'm not as in tune with World War One as I am with World War Two. My point being, it seems like there's a common problem here, and it's all the same problem. So how, in your estimation, could we avoid a global conflict considering that fact?
I think that the way to avoid global conflict is to repair the global economy. And, we have in the late 70s and aggressively through the 1980s, we interlocked the world by doing away with regulations on the flow of currents of money across borders, and gave individual speculators the ability to speculate in currencies, which led to the collapse of the Thai economy, the collapse of the Taiwanese economy, the Asian tiger collapse that happened in the, as I recall, the mid to late 80s, and that made a number of people, including George Soros, a lot of money, made them billionaires. And number one, we need to undo that. Number two, we need to allow countries to basically put an economic condom over themselves, create an impermeable, or the very best, at least semi-permeable membrane economically by doing away with these so-called free trade agreements and going back to allowing countries to have protectionist trade policies. So that you won't have, I realize there are people who argue that the interlocking and interdependence of the world economies reduces the risks of war. And I had this debate earlier this week or late last week on this program with one of our callers. I respectfully disagree. I think they enhance the risks of war. They increase the probability that one country's disaster is going to go worldwide. The blowback from that is that instability in one country can go worldwide as well, political instability caused by that economic instability. But see that, at the time that World War One happened, we did not have these free trade agreements. We had countries that were running nationalistic trade policies, which seems to argue against what I'm saying. And we had pretty aggressive currency controls, which seems to argue against what I'm saying. But what we didn't have at that time was the United Nations. And when Woodrow Wilson proposed the League of Nations after World War One, unsuccessfully, the United Nations didn't come about until after World War II. But when Woodrow Wilson proposed the League of Nations, he basically said every country in the world should, because World War One, all these countries declared war against each other out of treaty agreements and these kind of things in a way that was sort of like, dominoes falling or forest fire coming out of a campfire. What we need to do is have a series of treaties and agreements among countries that say no country, unless they are directly attacked, may declare war on or be aggressive against another country unless the world community agrees on it, and unless the League of Nations agrees on it. And this way we can avoid the kind of situation we had in World War One. And I think that he was right. And we created that after World War II in the United Nations. And I would argue that the United Nations has prevented a number of conflicts, although it has not been as effective as it should be. In large part, it didn't prevent Vietnam. It didn't prevent, the conflicts in the Balkans. It has not prevented a number of smaller conflicts. It did not prevent the Iraq War, and didn't prevent the Afghanistan War. And I would say the reason why is because we have too much power in the United Nations. Now, I realize that, right-wingers are going to get hysterical when you say that. But every country should be subordinate to this international rule that says that you can only go to war if you've been attacked. Am I making sense?
Well, but you are, absolutely. But here's just one follow-up that I'd like to ask you, though. The latter half of the equation seems to stem a lot of from our fossil fuel, continued fossil fuel dependence. So what does that fit in the equation?
Well, it's a good point. The U.S. trade deficit, about a third of it, is imported fossil fuels. The Middle East would not be an important region if they grew, if their principal export was turnips rather than oil. These are, kind of truisms, and they're absolutely true. My first point was that countries need to become independent before they become interdependent. And,
got it. Yeah.
And so part of becoming independent isn't just erecting barriers to trade like tariffs that protect domestic industries. It's also running your country on your own energy. And we have the technology now for every country in the world to do that. In fact, one of the really cool things that's happening in a lot of third world countries, and you see that, I saw this in South Sudan, and I've seen it in India, is rural areas that literally never had any kind of electricity. They never went through the fossil fuel revolution of the 19th and 20th centuries. They've gone right from being pastoralist, or in some cases agrarian, or in some cases hunting gathering societies, directly to having solar panels powering water pumps. They've just hopscotched right over the top of fossil fuels, right into solar power. And we need to be helping the world do that. We need to be creating, and we can do that very easily through a body like the United Nations, or through some sort of this is the area where maybe multilateral trade agreements of some sort might make sense, and that would be a worldwide carbon tax. Let's capture the externalities associated with burning fossil fuels, whether it's the cancer externalities, or whether it's the climate change externalities, or whether it's the asthma externalities. These are real costs that are dumped on we the people and not paid by the oil companies. And if the fossil fuel industry simply had to pay for the cost of these externalities, then that $2, 3, 4, 5 trillion or more, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, worth of fossil fuels, right, that are still under the ground in just in the North American continent, or just in the Americas, would suddenly have much, much less value. ExxonMobil would have to write down their balance sheet tremendously, which is what they're freaked out about. But you would see, all of a sudden solar power would be, and wind power would be, cheaper than natural gas or oil or coal. And the day that happens, you're going to see, as much as, right, I say that there's no such thing as free markets, you're going to see the marketplace drive a radical and dramatic change in energy policy. And that would be a good thing. That would be a good thing, because then you have independence rather than dependence. We're dependent right now in Saudi Arabia. It's not a good thing. If we put in the XL pipeline, we're dependent on Canada. It's not a good thing. Not because Canada might attack us, but because our trade deficit is actually worse for us than our budget deficit. Our trade deficit is the one we should be paying attention to. And if we're buying all that oil from Canada, that's just going to jack up our trade deficit. Patrick, thank you for the call. Very thoughtful call. I appreciate it. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, free-don.org. Check it out. Don Siegelman still in jail, America's political prisoner. We'll be back with more on Anything Goes Friday. I welcome there, Hitch. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's okay. It's kind of past. Let's see here. Bum-bum-bum-bum. My mouse just stopped working. Oh. It helps if you put your hand on the right part of it. Wayne in Lithonia, Georgia, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind? You want to talk about perpetual motion?
Yes, Tom. Can you hear me clearly?
I hear you very clearly. Can you hear me clearly?
Oh, yes. I hear you fine. Basically, let me start out by saying open source. That way, it doesn't bring on some feeling that I'm trying to look to make profit or something of that nature on it. I'm an inventor, and the one source of energy that is constant is gravity. And I've invented an engine that is perpetually, it resets itself utilizing gravity. And it's a high torque, low rotation engine. And basically, it is a source that as long as we maintain gravity, it'll work.
What is the unit of measurement? I know, for example, with light, you've got a photon as a unit of measurement. What is the unit of measurement for gravity?
The unit of measurement of gravity, it varies with the material that's used. In other words, uranium, depleted uranium being of higher density or mass, will produce more weight in a smaller space. And the offset of the engine itself as to how it's designed is also another factor in how well the engine works.
Okay, well, the reason I was asking that question was so that I could just ask the next question using the proper language, and apparently there isn't a term. There's not an erg or an ohm or a photon or something of gravity, or if there is, neither one of us knows what it is. But let's say a unit of gravity, okay? If it takes 10 units of if it takes the resistance against 10 units of gravity to lift a pound a foot in the air, and when that pound drops a foot, it releases 10 units of gravity.
Okay.
Are you with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. And this is the principle that Norway uses to store electric energy in the form of water. They, you know, when they're running surplus energy during the day, they actually pump their dams up. They refill their reservoirs, or at night rather, and then during the day when they need the extra electricity, they bring it down.
Right.
They bring it down. So they use dams and water behind them as a storage cell, basically. So how do you get more than 100%? If it takes 10 units of gravity to lift something up, how do you get 11 units dropping it?
Well, the principles are basically along the lines of something that hasn't been used before, which is offset energy. In other words,
what's the source of that energy?
A distant energy along an axis, and that energy being constantly cammed to an offset position creates an energy force that is continuous on the...
But you have to have some sort of lateral force to produce that offset. So you're putting an external energy source in here.
Well, it's not an external. It is internal to the source. It actually does work.
Huh. You got a website for it?
Yes, sir.
What is it?
Say again?
What is it? The website.
What is the website? I haven't designed a website.
Oh, okay. When you got a website, Wayne, I would love to take a look at it. Thank you for the call. Just, you know, give me a call. We'll put the URL on the air. People can check it out. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Luke Vargas and Zach Badorf with Talk Radio News Service, UN correspondents, are live in Kiev, Ukraine. And gentlemen, Luke, Zach, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening.
And thanks for being up in the middle of the night and for calling into our show. I'm not sure who I should start out with. You guys know each other. Whoever wants to take this first, what's the situation right now in Ukraine?
Hey, this is Luke, and Zach is just standing next to me in the courtyard here. Well, we came out here because I had been reporting on this from the UN back in November, which was the president, Yanukovych, here decided sort of at the last minute to forego a plan of further economic integration with the EU,
right,
and instead chose to take a couple billion dollars from Vladimir Putin instead. And that made a lot of people frustrated here, just sort of like jolted a change of direction, if you will, away from integration with the West. And when those protests were met with force, people got even more frustrated, and they expanded their list of grievances to include sort of the longstanding issues of this country, corruption, sort of an inflation of the roles of the office of the president. And since then, they've been occupying this area of downtown Kiev. It's about 10 city blocks. It includes now thousands of people living there pretty much full time, people eating there, sleeping there, people getting armed there. They're, you know, sort of militias that patrol around. It's a pretty intense degree of civil protest being exercised in the streets of the capital now.
My understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I've been saying this on the radio, and if I'm wrong, I want to correct it, is that Ukraine basically has two halves, the western half and the eastern half. The western half speaks Ukrainian and is more inclined to want to join the EU. The eastern half speaks principally Russian, is actually more ethnically Russian, and is inclined to want to be associated with Russia. And in fact, the word Ukraine used to mean border, which is why it used to be called the Ukraine, the border, the frontier between Russia and Europe. And first of all, am I right so far on this description?
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. I mean, to the extent where we've talked to a number of experts here who say, you know, it's just a difficult task to govern this country. You
right.
know, going to be pulled in one direction or
right.
another.
So relative to that yep. to that split in the context of that analysis, I don't know Ukrainian geography enough to know where Kiev is. Is it in the eastern part or the western part, or is it in the center? Oh, there's a map up on the screen. Oh, Kiev is right smack dab in the middle of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's about right, though. When you look at the demographics of the city, though, it does overwhelmingly support this protest movement. But it is a more cosmopolitan city. You know, they are more closely integrated with the capitals of Europe at this point.
Right.
Though we did have a chance to go down to the city of Sevastopol, which is a Black Sea port.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the Russians have a naval base. And actually, Zach really found that city to be quite amazing. So I'm going to throw it over to him just to say a little bit about what we saw there.
Yeah. Hey, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I'm familiar with Sevastopol and Simferopol. My daughter studied Russian there for a year when she was in college. So tell us
exactly.
about it.
So it is Russian-dominated, and you have a population that really thinks that these protesters here in Kiev are vandals, vigilantes, people who are destructive, and they have basically no support
right.
for what's happening in Kiev. They're more interested in aligning with Russia, and they don't really want to be moving toward East European Union. So we talked to a number of people there. We did see a very, very small movement of Maidan protesters who are doing their own little thing there. But it's, you know, for a gigantic city like Sevastopol, it's only about 100 people who were involved in this protest.
Is it
down there?
Is it possible that Ukraine could be facing a civil war, that it could tear apart?
We heard people talking about that, but I personally think that's very unlikely.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that, though, is, as you know about Sevastopol, is that there is this military base down there. There are thousands of Russian troops down there. And if this were to happen, if there were some civil war, I can pretty much guarantee that Russia would get involved, and that would be their entry port right there.
Yeah.
You know, they got the two special forces there already. They've got sailors down there. They would be moving up very quickly. To probably sort of, you know, quote unquote, liberate this area.
Yeah, yeah. Might there be you've got a country that's basically half aligned with Europe, and I'm the president, refresh my memory on his name.
Viktor Yanukovych.
Yanukovych. President Yanukovych did not speak Ukrainian until he was 50 years old. I mean, he's historically aligned with the eastern half, with the Russian half. Is there the country? If the country has to go all one way or the other half is going to be continuously unsatisfied. What is the solution?
That is a tough one, and I think that's what we're trying to learn out right now. I mean, they're fighting it out in the parliament as we speak, and you know, this is something that I think we're going to be moving toward. And I think I'll let Luke chime in here as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we've heard about these competing sort of economic deals that Ukraine might have either from the EU or from Russia is that the Russian one is certainly beneficial in the short term. I mean, they get essentially a very quick infusion of cash. They get deals on natural gas imports from Russia. But the sort of economic package doesn't include long-term restructuring of public finance. And that's sort of what the EU and the IMF are looking to do to Ukraine. And that's why it's taken them longer to react. You know, the reason that the president ended up going with this Russian deal is the terms that the EU were willing to put forward weren't good enough at the time being. So he looked for the better option immediately at hand. But people here do say that if the EU can finally cobble something together, bringing in U.S. Support for this, that
right.
they may be able to really.
Well, then, but then on top of that, we're talking with Luke Vargas and Zach Badoff. On top of that, you've got the problem that the EU is increasingly becoming neoliberal. Conservative economic policies, austerity, and all that kind of stuff. And that may or may not be a good thing. It doesn't seem to be working out all that well in Italy, for example.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell where this is going to go. I think politically speaking, there are a lot of problems that people have with the justice system here. They see the corruption at all levels. Right. Obviously there are problems with the EU. Common currency has certainly had its problems, as we see in Greece.
Yeah, although they're not talking about becoming a member of...
See the prospect of super national courts of justice as potentially, being something useful for them, helping them gain more access to their
Luke,
rights.
Zach, we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. Hang on thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Previously, we just had a report. We're talking on the phone live with Luke and Zach from the Talk Radio News Service, live from Kiev, Ukraine, about the situation in Ukraine. I opened the show 2 hours ago talking about my concern that Ukraine could be the next Sarajevo, as in 1914. Archduke Ferdinand, all that kind of stuff. And then also I went into this Financial Times Newsmind thing back 2 hours ago about how basically all the major stories of this week in the Financial Times are about how the world economy is getting fragile, how the shadow banking system is larger than it has been since 2006 at the height of the credit bubble. That's a verbatim quote. How companies are having more and more difficulty raising equity, raising money. People are not, the venture capital market is drying up, particularly for so-called junk bonds for small companies, companies with lower credit scores. And this is because you've got corporations, you've got five companies sitting on $387 billion, according to the New York Times, according to the Financial Times, and you've got couple hundred, maybe 1,000 companies worldwide sitting on over $2 trillion. Over $700 billion has been used for corporate buybacks in the last year, stock buybacks. It's like, let's get ourselves out of the market now while it's at the peak. Let's profit from the froth. It's just very interesting. And then on top of this, you get this report from the Wall Street Journal that one in six men between the ages of 25 and 54, the prime working years, are unemployed. They don't have a job. One out of six American men between 25 and 54 don't have a job. This is a lost generation. And the jobs report, of course, came out today, and it wasn't so good. This is also the consequence of 6 years of Republican obstruction against anything that might improve the economy. This is a real demonstration of how effective John Boehner and Mitch McConnell have been at sabotaging the Obama presidency and the Democratic Party in their attempts to make the government the employer of last resort, to stimulate the government stimulate the economy through government spending on things like infrastructure, rebuilding our roads, putting in a national broadband system, whatever it may be. You got ALEC now sponsoring legislation that's being proposed in Kansas that, and I don't know if the Kansas one was an ALEC model bill or not, but ALEC has a similar model bill that says that it's illegal for any city or county within a state to do what Chattanooga, Tennessee has done. We talked about this last week on the program, and that is offer high-speed broadband at a low price to their citizens, because the citizens themselves own the system. In other words, the city owns it. The city, then the citizens own the city. Make that illegal. Right? You are required to buy your internet from a for-profit company, which then can, you know, gouge you and rip you off in a thousand different ways, especially since this D.C. Circuit Court ruling that said that net neutrality is dead. And how the corporate media is not talking about the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, which the administration would prefer to call by the name Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. I'd rather like SHAFTA. They're refusing to talk to it. There's a blackout in the corporate media because these are all transnational corporations who own this media. It ain't happening. It's happening basically on talk radio, both on the right and left. But that's it. On the TPP, nobody's, you know, really seriously. There's a variety of issues, actually, that nobody's is seriously talking about. You know, net neutrality got blown up 2 weeks ago by the courts here in D.C., and nobody talking about it. Why? Well, the internet companies own one of the big three television networks is owned by an internet company. That might have something to do with it. It's just and then we've got, you know, global warming has changed the temperature gradient between the mid latitudes, the North American latitudes, and the Arctic latitudes to the point where the wall of temperature difference, you know, how a front as a cold front moves through or a warm front moves through, the difference between the air behind and the air ahead, the point where those two air masses collide, that's called the front. And the intensity of the storms created by that front is pretty much purely a function of the difference in moisture between the two masses of air, and more importantly, the differences in temperature between the two masses of air. So it's that temperature gradient, the difference in temperature. And because the Arctic has been warming four times faster than the mid-latitudes over the last 30 years, that wall of cold air, that temperature gradient wall that used to hold the jet stream up, you know, in northern Canada and up around, you know, circling the North Pole, has started slipping. It's just not strong enough to hold the jet stream up there any longer. So now you got the jet stream dipping all the way down to Texas and Florida and bringing with it polar air, the so-called polar vortex. And is anybody in the media in the United States talking about the fact that this is caused by global warming? You know, there's a few climatologists, and it's in the few scientific journals, but no. And this polar air, when it comes down over the North American continent, even though it is winter, I mean, it's going fairly far south. And what's it doing? It's pulling heat out of the ground. The ground is freezing. And buildings and everything else. Where is that heat going to go? Well, when summer comes and the jet stream sort of recovers, it's going to take that heated air back up over the North Pole. And it's going to speed up the rate at which the North Pole is warming, which is going to decrease that temperature gradient. It's going to make the situation even worse. The next winter is going to be even worse than this winter. Not necessarily year by year, but, you know, over time, the trend lines. We might have already passed a tipping point with regard to our climate on this. Or we might be approaching one. And it's like people are dithering about consensus. So anyhow, and 1914 we've been talking about a fair amount here are we on the edge? So, but it's Anything Goes Friday, so let's pick up your calls. Jay in Scappoose, Oregon. Hey Jay, you have an anecdote about Woodrow Wilson?
I do, but first I wanted to tell you that Art Robinson is now the party chairman of the Oregon Republican Party.
I know, and it's mind-boggling. This is the guy who ran against Peter DeFazio, and he homeschooled his kids because he believes that public education is wrong and it's government tyranny. And he believes that, and he proposed, he used to be a science teacher apparently, and he proposed that we take radioactive waste, the nuclear waste from all the nuclear plants in the United States, dilute it down, because it continuously generates heat, you know, dilute it down and put it in housing insulation for people's houses as a way of getting rid of it, of disposing of the radioactive waste, and exposing all of us to low levels of continuous low levels of radiation throughout our lives, so we'll like get used to it or something.
Speaking of that, the country, you said one country disaster could be a worldwide disaster.
Yes, sir.
And instead of these wars, they should be looking at Fukushima.
Yes.
And that's how much food is that going to take out of the food supply? But now, Woodrow Wilson, whose name was Thomas, I will give you that. He wrote limericks. And so as a Anything Goes Friday, so it's something a little different. Woodrow Wilson wrote this limerick.
Okay.
As I sat with the Duchess of Tea, it was just as I feared it would be. For her rumblings abdominal were truly phenomenal. And everyone thought it was me.
Truly abdominal.
Friday, Tom.
Thank you very much, Jay. Who would have known? We'll be back in just a minute. Who would have known that Woodrow Wilson was writing limericks that were basically fart jokes? It's like, somebody call Stephanie, quick. 15 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's Stephanie, of course, is Stephanie Miller. StephanieMiller.com, isn't it? Is that her website? Yes, it is. Indeed, she's brilliant. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Actually, 16 minutes after the hour in 4 seconds. Right, Shane? Except for the delay. Yeah, okay. Our clocks are working. Gee, that's pretty impressive. John in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Thanks for calling in. What's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, you've been talking about the dirty little secrets of the TPP and all that. And let's talk about the other dirty little secret that's nationwide, and that's called the nursing home industry.
Yeah.
And how with this new Affordable Care Act and whatever, the state of Missouri refused to take the Medicaid money from it, and now there's facing problems with the number of beds in the nursing homes being available to the Medicaid patients. That's becoming a bigger problem here in the state of Missouri, which is probably all throughout the state. And the funny part about it is that usually the federal government usually comes in to build these nursing homes, and these politicians that are up in Washington seem to take a lot of benefit from it. In fact, the senior senator from Missouri, Claire McCaskill, that's how she made her money, is through the nursing home industry.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
You know, this is the dirty little secret nationwide of, you know, and if you talk to any of them, Republicans or Democrats, these politicians up there, they tend to not talk about the nursing home industry that much. It's more of a hidden, I mean, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, they had many people that were in nursing homes that weren't evacuated that actually died from drowning from it.
Right.
I mean, the nursing home industry is not very, very lightly regulated. They don't talk about it much in the news media.
Is much of it or most of it a private for-profit industry now?
Yeah. Well, it's not for profit. There's a lot of them that are not for profit and a lot of them that are for profit. And so the industry, I mean, I hope that you do an in-depth look at this. Because what I'm finding out is that it's a real big moneymaker for both politicians and private individuals.
And there's some real hell holes out there. And I can tell you, you know, from personal experience, when we all lived in Vermont back, in the early 2000s, my wife's grandmother, who was in, I think she was 96 years old, she was in her 90s. The last couple of years of her life, she had to be institutionalized. We had to find a nursing home for her. And we put her in one place that we thought was a good place, and all they wanted to do was drug her into a zombie state. They basically used drugs as a form of behavior control. And we moved her to another place, and they wanted to basically do the same thing. I mean, it was just bizarre. And then she died. And then when my mom got Alzheimer's and was dying, my brother took her in because the nursing homes that he was seeing and that we were seeing as a family just, you know, they were, some of them were just horror shows. I think Americans are waking up to that, but there hasn't been a good national discussion about it. You're absolutely right, John. And the other part of it with regard to Medicaid is that if you're over 55 and you take Medicaid money, it's not a grant, it's a loan, and you have to pay it back. And so it's the final wipeout. The nursing home industry gets the final savings of retired people and elderly people, and in some cases even their immediate families. And this is something that needs to be fixed as well. Medicaid should be turned into, for people over 55, a grant like it is for people under 55. John, thanks a lot for the call. You raised a really important issue. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, a progressive reporter. You've been at the Progressive Media Forum, Mark?
Yes. Well, we're having a huge Seahawks party, of course, as you know, and I'm very proud of the fact that our city could get together in a group of 700,000 and there are no arrests. So kudos to Seattle.
Yeah.
Also, our $15 an hour minimum wage campaign, I think, is going to get a boost by the cuts in unemployment and food stamps. And Shama Sawant, our socialist Occupy City Council member, is leading a very, very organized group. The unions and the progressive groups and the politicians have got together here, Tom, in a way I've never seen before behind this issue. So I'm really excited about that. But, yeah, we did have a progressive media forum here a couple weeks ago. And as you know, we're lucky to have you up here on KBC. But most of the progressive voices on KPTK are now gone off the airwaves in Seattle.
Right, I know.
We had a local gathering, and we had David Goldstein, the local blogger. We had journalist John Parrish, and we had Norman Goldman, who gave a really great presentation on what's happening with the corporations who have bought up all these radio stations. If people are interested in this issue, I did write an article over at Op-Ed News about it that seems to be getting some attention from media consultants because of what I wrote about.
It's opednews.com.
OpEdNews.com, correct. Right. But Bain Capital apparently is one of the groups that folks like Clear Channel have borrowed billions of dollars from to buy up their 880 radio stations around the country at what Goldman calls, you know, amazing interest rates, what he compares to, you know, Vinny from the East River type rates.
Well, it's a little more complex than that. Bain bought Clear Channel and then put the debt on Clear Channel. But it's, you know, anyhow, but... So what's going on with the Progressive Media Forum?
Well, what we've got up here is we've got the PRNW.org group. It's Progressive Radio Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
And they have been having these forums and trying to get progressive voices back on the air in Seattle, which just happens to be one of the most progressive cities in the country. So it would be great to have more of your kind of programming.
Well, I'm assuming KBCS has good local progressive programming, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yes.
KBCS is a Pacifica affiliate.
Right.
Another news on that is it looks like Free Speech Radio News might be back. That's a program that I reported for quite a while.
That is great.
But yeah,
let me mention, by the way, KBCS, to our Seattle listeners, KBCS is doing their fundraising drive right now, and their number is 425-564-5000. And let me say, I said it in the first hour, or an hour ago, I guess it was, we had a caller from KPFK. But I just repeat it. For our commercial stations, I regularly record spots for sponsors that I know of and that I like. They're commercial stations. I want to support them. For our non-commercial stations, if you're in a fund drive, you know, let me know. I'm glad to come on your air and help you raise money. And I will also, when we're live on the air on your station, I'll mention the fact that you're in a fund drive. I believe WBAI is in a fundraising drive right now in New York City. And so, you know, you should listen. If you're listening at BAI, you should listen for the liners and catch the phone number, give them a call. Back to you, Mark, in the Progressive Media Forum.
Well, it's very, very important that people support progressive media in the United States. One of the things that I give webinars about and talk about all the time is that we were rated last year on the Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Index as 37th in the world in terms of press freedom. So we need to do better in this country. And it's not a state-run media so much as it's a corporate-run situation. And so people need to look all over the world at what's happening to journals, not just in the U.S. Project Censorship is a great website.
Yeah.
We've also got a campaign going on right now for Al Jazeera reporters around the world that are being imprisoned. And there's a hashtag that's hashtag ALPress that people are writing on that. And one reporter, Bob Grest, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, but it's G-R-E-S-T-E. He set up a Twitter site, and he's now currently
tweeting from jail in Egypt about what it's like to be a reporter and be arrested because
wow.
you're trying to tell the truth to people.
Wow.
Very important issue.
Amazing,
very
amazing
cool.
stuff. Mark Taylor Canfield, thanks, Mark. And you can check out Mark's writing over at opednews.com. That's a great piece. Wayne in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Wayne.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay, yes. I just wanted to make a few comments mm-hmm. about the Keystone Pipeline. You know, you had a caller earlier talking about Henry Ford. And the thing is, when Henry Ford started manufacturing cars, he wanted to use alcohol. And John Rockefeller wanted him to use gas.
Right.
You know, from oil that Rockefeller was refining.
Right.
So Rockefeller gave him an offer he couldn't refuse. You know, you either use my gas that I'm refining from my oil or else. So he took the oil else, and that's why he used the gas to fuel his cars.
But right. My recollection is that part of that or else was that Rockefeller was colluding with the big railroad giants, and they were refusing to ship kerosene and unrefined oil for Rockefeller's competitors, which is how he put people out of state, out of business all across Pennsylvania, Ohio, and other states. And that he was threatening Henry Ford that he would not transport cars by rail. But I could be wrong.
Actually, it got personal. He was actually threatening his physical safety.
Oh, really? Okay.
Deeper than that.
Wow.
So what the reason why I'm bringing this up is it's a lot of psychopathy involved with this. The definition of psychopath is the main two red flag definitions are lack of empathy and no remorse.
Right.
So those are the two things that are the main red flags of a psychopath. Most people think of psychopaths, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy. The overwhelming majority of psychopaths are not violent at all.
No, they're working in the banks and at the top levels of our corporations, or they're in jail.
So, I mean, most of the oil executives, for instance, they know what they're doing to the earth. Most
yeah.
of them know.
I'm with you, Wayne. They would have to be psychopaths. Thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, how could you wake up every day and say, okay, I'm going to make $1 billion by destroying the planet and its future and not be a psychopath? Occupying the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Pat in the Dalles, Oregon. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi. You wanted to talk about bankers killing themselves?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you heard any more about that. I went to Truth Dig, and I just gave the basic news, and mm-hmm. I was wondering why this hasn't been on the main news. You know, it's kind of astonishing, you know, and
yeah.
You know, and there's no background on these people or hardly, and, you know, why they committed suicide.
It appears, yeah, there was one guy with Deutsche Bank, and there was a guy with a bank out of London, and there was three bankers have committed suicide, and one financial reporter who has gone missing since the early part of this year. And, you know, there are people who are constructing around that some sort of conspiracy theory that these guys knew something that the rest of us don't know, or they were about to be prosecuted and they didn't want to face it, or whatever. I honestly don't know. Pat, I'm sorry, I don't know any more than you do about it. I've read the news reports. I've seen the speculation. I think the fact that every day more than three of our soldiers commit suicide, soldiers who have suffered as a consequence of our sending them to Vietnam or to Iraq or Afghanistan or, you know, name the place where there was combat. That's an even bigger story, frankly, that is completely unreported. But the idea, the storyline, the narrative goes that these guys committed suicide because they knew that a big crash is coming. I don't buy that. I don't think that you have to, you don't have to have inside information to know that a big crash is coming. All you have to do is read the Financial Times. And B, it's not something to commit suicide over. You commit suicide after the financial crash has come. So it may just be you know, people, it may just be a coincidence, or it might be the first time that anybody's really been paying any attention. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan.
Did you want to do pharmacopic? Did you want to do financial or political?
It's up to you. The note here says you wanted to talk about the economy, but it's anything goes Friday, so whatever you'd like.
If you knew the four reasons of the 1865 through 1871 that crashed the market then.
Okay. What were they?
I'm waiting to see if you know any of them.
Oh, and not off the top of my head. No, I'm sorry.
Okay. The first one was the Chicago Fire by Catherine O'Malley was never really caused by her, and she went to her grave not speaking anymore.
Right.
I'm quoting from a book my grandmother gave me when I was in the fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
It's an 1898 history book.
Okay.
History book. I'd hate to have to pay the fine.
Yeah.
The other was a fellow by the name of Gould that decided he wanted to change the prospects of the gold standard, and so him and his friends inflated and then dropped it for a day, and there was a scurry on the market, as you can imagine.
Right, and Gould had made his original money as a railroad baron, had he not?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other was Mr. Tweed and how they basically tried to bankrupt New York.
Yeah, Boss Tweed.
Yeah, and his whole posse, and they all tried to, like, jump boats to Cuba and some really fascinating things. I really wish I could send you copies of this, but I don't want to crack the book.
Yeah. You may find that somebody has already digitized it. You might want to look around the web.
I don't really go near the web. I have a medical device that's kind of like a pacemaker. It's made of titanium.
Okay.
So I get hot when I'm near electromagnetic.
Yeah. No problem.
You might want to go to a site called Karlinsky Report because, yes, electromagnetic resonancy occurs on things other than cell phones.
Sure.
But the final thing, getting back to, and maybe you can help me out here, as for the financial, first I saw it on Al Jazeera, and they reported on the crawl, the little, what was first known as Bloomberg crawl, then finally, unmuted, Bloomberg makes a remark about it, stating that if you're going into foreclosure on your home, now that the market is just in a recession and it's going to pick back up, this bubble really doesn't exist. Sure, I'm blowing, but yeah, I've got gray hairs too. I'm a little wiser. But what's fascinating is they say that the write-down on my house would be at $150,000, which is what it's valued at, because we had this quantitative easing. Yeah, except for everyone that's, you know, suffering from it. But then I'd have to file it on the 2015 income documents as income. Isn't
wow. You have lost me, Susan. I don't know the details of that. What does that have to do with the fourth reason why the market fell apart in the mid late 19th century?
Had been citing that in your book, the book that you just published about 2016.
Right.
That there were four, and I just wanted to find out if you knew what the four reasons were during that time frame.
Okay.
Ulysses S. Grant, and did you know that Ulysses S. Grant? The S had no meaning. He just wanted it to be a political campaign.
Yeah, it was not his legal name. Yeah, but he wanted to be called U.S. Grant. Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah.
And Grant was, pretty. He was so corrupt that his own Republican Party would not renominate him for a third term, which he wanted to have happen. The crash that we talk about in the book was the one in 1856, the one that preceded the Civil War, which arguably had more to do with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the collapse of the Southern economy as a consequence of the cotton gin and steam engines and things. And there's a whole bunch of things associated with that. But thank you for that piece of history. And, it's fascinating. Susan, thank you for the call. George in Keyport, New Jersey, listening on WBAI. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to comment on that fact you threw out at the beginning of this hour about the men that are out of work between 25 and 54.
Yeah, one in six American men. This is astounding. We haven't seen this since the 30s.
I was one of those people. I had worked for a company for 24-plus years. They had their manufacturing operations down in Mexico, and then they decided that it would be cheaper to do the manufacturing over in China. And then they decided that they needed someone that would do the exact same function I did over in China next to their manufacturing operations. So after 24-plus years, I was laid off.
Wow.
Just so people understand, when they hired a person in China, they made about 10% of what I was making here in the States. And then I was asked to train my replacement, and I trained them without any hesitation because I figured they were paying me, and that's what they wanted me to do. Yeah. I was out of work for 97 weeks.
Wow.
I had 2 weeks of unemployment left because that was part of the government extension at the time.
Right.
And just during those 2 years I was out of work, I applied to over 600 jobs, and I took the first job I was offered. And I'm in my 50s, and people could read my resume and see that I had a lot of experience and that I was older, and I couldn't never prove it, but I think I was discriminated against because they knew I was older and I wasn't new out of school or somebody younger. In
it. Oh, there's no doubt about it. And companies are looking at kids who are graduating from college with $60,000 in student debt who are so desperate to work that they'll work for minimum wage or something close to it, compared to somebody like yourself who has... You know, who was presumably working for something, you know, probably at least two or three times minimum wage. And they're like, you know, why should I hire somebody who eventually is going to be a malcontent or something because, you know, they're not going to be happy with a $7.50 an hour job or an $8 an hour job because they've seen the other side of life, you know.
Yes. And, you know, it really burns me up the fact that they keep, denying this extension of the unemployment benefit because having been there, I woke up every day as if I was going to work and I was looking for a job. I scoured the net. I looked every place under every stone looking for a job, anything that I would be able to support my family.
Oh, this is morally criminal. This is morally criminal. Yeah. I was over at the Capitol yesterday when they held the vote on the unemployment. And you know, when all the senators ran in to vote for it. And in fact, I was in a little train on the way over there with Senator Rubio and a couple of others. It was very interesting. And it's like, you know, it lost by two votes. Well, it didn't actually. It won by eight. 58 out of 100 senators voted to extend unemployment insurance. But the Republicans filibustered it. And so they couldn't get cloture. So Harry Reid had to vote no so that he could bring it back up again. So it really lost by one vote. And that could have been any one Republican. Actually, there were four Republicans who voted in favor of it. If they'd had one more Republican, this thing would have passed. But they couldn't find one Republican who had enough of a conscience to say, yeah, let's look out for 1.7 million people who have several million children who are days away, weeks away, in some cases, from being homeless. I mean, it's criminal. George, thank you for the call, and thanks for putting a human face on unemployment. I honor you. Kent in Henderson, Arkansas. Kent, we have just a minute to the break. It's yours.
Yeah, on Monday, the Arkansas State Legislature, they're mainly Republican, say they're going to repeal our version of the ACA.
Mm.
They have the votes. We have 87,000 people on it, including my wife who has cancer, and they are going to repeal it, according to them.
Oh my! Did they pull it off, or are they going to vote on it next Monday?
On Monday they meet and they say that's the first thing they're taking up.
Yeah.
And all of them have taken Koch brother money, and we used to be Democratic, but it's been flipped to Republican now, thanks to the Kochs.
Yeah, well, it's not just the Kochs. There's a whole bunch of other billionaires involved and big multinational corporations. If you want to say thanks to, you really need to say thanks to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court discovered somehow that, you know, in the Buckley case back 38 years ago, and then with Citizens United amplifying it, discovered that the First Amendment protects money. And, you know, the founders, they were not about that at all, but that's what they discovered. Thanks a lot, Kent, for the call. Good to hear from you. I hope that you are protected in this. I hope that the Republicans don't do this to you in Arkansas. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, and we will be right back. It's Anything Goes Friday. Check out free-don.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you, 15 minutes before the hour, and John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with your caller from Chicago who said that corporations often act like sociopaths. Goldman Sachs is one of those corporations, and this story was in Harper's about just after you know, the mortgage meltdown. And what they were doing is bundling up commodities like winter wheat. And, you know, here in this country, it's not as much of an issue because, you know, yeah, our bread goes up 50 cents or something like that. But in Africa and in some other places in the world, it literally went up 30% and 40%. So that they actually caused people to starve.
There were food riots all over the world. Hundreds of millions of people were affected by Goldman Sachs cornering the actually creating this commodities index. They're still running the thing, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, they still are. I mean, the grain exchange here to create a stable price, but they weren't happy with that. So they wanted to make it so that it was, you know, sexier and, you know, you could, you know, jack up the price.
Well, it used to be, you know, before Phil Graham, it used to be that if you wanted to trade in commodities, you had to be willing to take delivery. You had to be a counterparty. You had either had to actually provide the wheat or you had to actually take the wheat once the contract ran out. And, you know, once they changed the rules so that banksters could get in the middle, then the banksters would start buying up all the wheat, jack the price up, and then they'd, you know, sell it out and just, you know, it's a disaster. John, you're absolutely right. So say hi to your dog for me, would you?
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. I had a dog from the day I was born until our last dog, Sabra, died about 10 years ago. I miss having dogs. You can't have a dog on the river, really. It's kind of tough. Roger in Laguna Woods, California. Hey, Roger. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Hi. The reason I was calling is 25 states refused to take the Medicaid expansion money. I was just wondering if the federal government could take that money and provide Medicare to just those people.
Unfortunately, they can't. The law was written in such a way that there was a presumption that all states would take it. In fact, all states were required to take it. The Supreme Court, John Roberts, said, and this said, that's a violation of the Ninth Amendment. And the 10th Amendment, this, you know, the state's rights, basically. And therefore, states cannot be forced to take money. And so the states could turn down Obamacare. And so, which, by the way, is how when Medicaid first rolled out, it was optional. States, you know, it took about 6 years for all the states to get on board. I think this is going to take about 6 years for all the states to get on board also. So Roberts flipped Medicaid back to the way it was when it first rolled out. And the consequence of that is you've got five and a half million people roughly who are, you know, who are in dire poverty and they don't qualify for free health care, which is just just so wrong.
Yeah, but my suggestion is not giving the money to the states, is having the federal government provide Medicare to those 5 million people.
It would be a great thing, but it would require legislation because it would involve federal expenditures, and you're not going to get that legislation out of the Republican-controlled House of Representatives because they're not going to do anything to make the Affordable Care Act work. They're not going to do anything to help people. They want people in pain so that those people will blame that pain on President Obama. This is all about destroying the Obama legacy. It really, really is. This is the most vicious sociopathic behavior that I think we've ever seen in the history of American politics. We'll be back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various companies that syndicate this program and organizations, Westwood One on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on the non-commercial side, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network into cable TV systems around the country, Free Speech TV and Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network in New York City, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and all the folks in our chat room. Hey, how you doing? To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, the radio or television station you may be listening or watching to this program on, our sponsors and our underwriters, and to you, in particular, to you for supporting this program. You make it happen. Thank you. And please, if you have an opportunity, thank the however you are getting this program, thank them, particularly if you're listening on one of our Pacifica affiliates like KBCS or WBAI. I don't know if KPFK is in a fund drive right now or not. I believe BAI is, and I know KBCS is, you know, pitch in and help. If you're listening on a commercial station, then, you know, please contact the advertisers and tell them that you're listening. And, you know, maybe you're not even buying the product. You don't need a new sofa right now, but you call them up and say, you know, when I do, I will call you because you supported this radio station or, you know, whatever the outlet may be, and tell your friends about it, because that's how we make this work. And you are doing that. You are doing that, and I appreciate that. Yvonne in Chamisal, New Mexico. Am I saying that right?
Yes, that's Chamisal. That's correct.
Hey, Yvonne, you wanted to talk about Norway and Massachusetts?
Yes, I heard you say in Norway they have a facility that they pump water up at night and then let the water down through a turbine to generate electricity.
During the day, yeah, when the demand is higher, yeah.
Yes. Well, we have a facility like that here in the United States in Northfield Mountain in Northfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, great.
That takes water from the Connecticut River, pumps it up to a reservoir at nighttime, and then during the day, it goes down through electricity and goes back into the Connecticut River.
Oh, that's marvelous. I didn't know that. Well, thank you for the heads up on that. See, that, yeah. And this is a way that you just use water like it's a giant battery. And, you know, so people say, well, you know, hi, solar electricity, what are you going to do, you know, what are you going to do at night when there's no, well, you know, there's a lot of ways to store electricity, and this is one. You know, there's others. You can use it with a little bit of electrolysis in water. I saw a statistic the other day that power plants in the United States, heat-driven power plants, which would be nuclear, gas, coal, oil, heat-using power plants use 6 times more water than humans do, than all of us as people do, just generating electricity, just these power plants. And if we were to convert these power plants to solar power, then we would not be using that water. You know, certainly not 6 times. We could use a tiny fraction of that water to run the electricity through it, split it into hydrogen and oxygen, capture the hydrogen and store it. And then, you know, when we need that energy back during, you know, like at night, if solar power is the other way around, when you need that power back at night, then, you know, you run that hydrogen through fuel cells or you burn it. And although fuel cells are more efficient, and you produce the surplus electricity. Yvonne, thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. That's great. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Your show is so educational, I have to take notes.
Thank you.
It really is.
So are many of my callers. I take notes.
Yes, yes. Good. I always like to talk about positive efforts to organize, to do community organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recently discovered what's going on in Detroit, which is the model for what to do in communities that have been deindustrialized. Detroit is the pioneer of deindustrialization, right?
Right. You're talking about the suburbs where they're tearing down houses, creating community gardens.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yes, exactly. But there's something else. You know, there are cooperation efforts that are between workers' co-ops, unions, and community organizations,
mm-hmm.
which is what everybody should be doing.
Right.
And specifically, there's a thing called the Detroit Community Cooperative Initiative,
mm-hmm.
and they are sponsoring workers' co-ops all over Detroit. There's an effort to convert there's two efforts that I wanted to talk about. One is to do restaurants and make restaurants into community co-ops, and they've got a lot of those. And then in terms of unions, the United Food and Commercial Workers, the UFCW, has gotten together over 80 stores, which they have A, unionized, and B, turned into wholly employer-owned ESOPs.
Wow.
Yeah.
Employee Stock Option Plan is what the ESOP is an acronym for, right? Where the employees, you know, eventually end up owning the company.
That's over 15,000 workers in 80 stores that are in ESOPs, in addition to the restaurants that are mm-hmm. being turned into worker co-ops.
That's marvelous. I mean, this is an intentional, methodical way of doing what they did in Argentina during the crash in 2000-2001 in Argentina, where, you know, all these foreign companies just walked away from their factories, and the workers said, that's fine, we'll continue to show up, and we're just going to take this sucker over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But what's beautiful about this is that the unions are participating.
Right.
And this thing, the Detroit Community Cooperative Initiative, say that they're an alliance of over 30 organizations, and they say community-based enterprises, worker cooperatives, community organizations.
We had Leo Girard of the Steelworkers Union on this program about 4 or 5 weeks ago talking about this, Lawrence. And he's very, very hot on this, very involved with it. And you're absolutely right. It's a brilliant, brilliant example. Thanks for calling and making the point. Coming up Monday on the program, we're going to have a conversation with Congressman Keith Ellison about race, faith, progressive politics, and what it means to be an American today, plus all the latest news and information you will not hear on the corporate-owned news media, together with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does require you. So get out there and get active and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.